This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose above 3% on Tuesday, its highest level since January 2014. The main force behind the rising yields is growing speculation that the Federal Reserve will be more aggressive in lifting interest rates. Yields started heading higher after a number of Fed officials rekindled the idea that the central bank could raise interest rates four times in 2018 and not the three times previously expected. Anytime interest rates rise, it can have a significant effect on the economy and on your finances.
We start off with a rally that many wish was not happening. Talking about the pain at the pump, gas prices are nearing $3 a gallon as oil has jumped 5% in the past month alone. That certainly has helped energy stocks, but could higher prices at the pump actually hit the consumer and send consumer-facing stocks reeling? This ahead of a big couple of weeks for retail earnings.
Well, mortgage interest rates hit a 7-year high as mortgage rates got over 4.5, actually reaching 4.6%. Interest rates, one of the big stories of the week as they continue to rise. We are now firmly over 3%. All of that is impacting the markets. And it's not just interest rates, it's also rising oil prices with $71 oil on this Friday, and now they're talking about $80 oil. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in Hour 1, my technician will be Gary Dorsch. Gary's a little bit more on the cautious side. He said, well, there's some positive things going on for the market in terms of corporate buybacks, which were at record levels. And, of course, you have those FANG stocks. He goes, but outside a handful of stocks and corporate buybacks, what else is holding the market? He's turned cautious. Also joining me on the program will be Kurt Wolf as we talk about oil prices. They've reached his target of $70 a barrel, but they could be going higher to $80. And how about this? Even mid-tiered producers in the oil industry are paying dividends that are close to 3%. Kurt Wolf will be my guest in the latter half of the first hour. And of course, Ryan Poplava will be here talking about what moved the markets this week. All of that coming up in Hour 1.
And I'm John Loeffler. You know, ever since January of this year, after puttering along for a couple of years quite nicely, the stock market has been unable to sustain any kind of a rally, which seems to surprise a lot of people if we look at the fundamentals. I mean, earnings are accelerating, GDP growth is picking up, there's government stimulus, unemployment at record low. So why have the stocks done nothing but go sideways? And what may be causing a lot of the volatility that we're going to see from this point forward? And of course, always, what does that mean coming up for investors? That'll be in the first part of the big picture today. And it's no secret this year that commodities have been doing quite nicely as an asset class, especially oil, which is up 75% since last summer. So looking at that, and despite problems which may be coming in from the geopolitical scene, are these commodities the opportunity of a lifetime or just a late cycle bounce? That'll all be coming up today on The Big Picture as part of the Financial Sense News Hour. And as one of my favorite parts of the program every week, we go over to Ryan Poplava, CEO of Financial Sense Wealth Management, to discuss the catalysts and drivers influencing the financial market. So here's one of those open questions, Ryan. What can you tell us that were some of the key stories this week?
Love to, but John, you just said I'm your favorite. I just want to make note of that.
Okay. You want me to keep this recording so you can document it for future occasions?
Yeah. Yes, please.
Okay, I'll do that. So yeah,
we'll reference it later. Yeah, so this week there were a lot of stories that took place, a very busy week in news, a lot of headlines, not a whole lot that actually shifted the consensus view from last week that rates are headed higher and so is oil. However, higher rates aren't helping financials because one of the issues right now that hasn't changed is the yield curve continues to remain very flat. And the banks need that spread, you know, loaning out at the long end at higher rates, borrowing at the short-term rate. But getting into it here, essentially there's quite a few events and stories in trade this week with some progress between China and the U.S. We got many economic announcements that pushed the dollar and treasuries higher in the U.S. and it was like Fed speak week, just essentially a ton of Fed officials highlighting many topics around monetary policy this week. So over the big pond, something I want to point out, this big pond we call the Atlantic over in Italy, there was quite the upset over a leaked draft from some of the plans the new coalition agreement between the Five Star Movement and the League had, with essentially intentions to ask the ECB, the European Central Bank, to write off $250 billion in Italian debt. And this just created such a wave of issues with interest rates over there, bonds just plummeting, rates skyrocketing, and currencies dropping. Friday, the two parties said they almost had an agreement, and those provisions to write off that Italian debt were left out. However, they did say that something in there was to propose that Italian bonds bought by the ECB under essentially their buying program should not be counted towards the country's gross debt to GDP ratio. That'd be nice, right? You know, Eurostat said absolutely no. And so the initial salvo of essentially writing off that debt sent, like I said, bonds values just plunging in Europe. The Italian BTP touching a high of 2.11%, up, that was like 16 basis points that day, and up 40 basis points from the lows in April. So huge adjustments there. The rout essentially caused the euro to fall 0.25% all in that one day, and the benchmark stock index for the Borsa Italiana to drop so far around 3% this week. Other than that, equities in the U.S. seem to take kind of a breather, John, from the last 2 weeks' rally. And so a lot of that was based off of a lot of trade going on. We had some great information on Monday with Trump and trying to work things out around ZTE. And throughout the rest of the week, there were some comments from Trump that things weren't actually going as well as planned.
Okay, so let's discuss trade. I mean, that's been a topic for most of the year between tariffs and talk of reducing the trade deficit between the U.S. and China. And Ryan, you mentioned there was some progress this week. Now, were you inferring the comments from President Trump to the U.S. Commerce Department to find a way for ZTE to get back into business here and to supposedly, quote, get it done, end quote?
Yeah, that was essentially a real big help to equities kicking off the week on Monday. And also on the news that China would reopen its review of Qualcomm's proposed $44 billion acquisition of NXP Semiconductors. But more, I was referring to some of the headlines from Bloomberg article Thursday night that China offered to cut the annual trade surplus by $200 billion. And that China would end its anti-dumping and anti-subsidy investigations into the U.S. imports of sorghum. So according to an anonymous source, it was quoted on Bloomberg from one of the officials. I don't know which side. It wasn't very clear. But Friday, China denied these reports. And the vice premier, Li Hu, is in Washington this week. But so far, the only thing we've heard from Trump was he's, like I said, just doubtful an agreement will be reached. Just a reminder here, the U.S. has threatened to impose 25% in punitive duties on up to $150 billion in Chinese goods, while China has targeted $50 billion in U.S. exports. Speaking of trade, John, interestingly, on Friday, I noted that Japan told the World Trade Organization it was reserving the right to impose tariffs on the U.S. if it doesn't get a steel and aluminum exemption. So trade is still very much in focus, and so far, no resolutions yet. Even with NAFTA, some of the talks there between Canada, Mexico, and the U.S., there hasn't been any real progress yet on that either.
Yeah, and President Trump has said that trade with China has been one-sided for too long, and then, of course, politics comes in here. He blames previous administrations. It's going to be really tough for the president to get concessions without the Chinese getting something in return if he's actually trying to balance the scales. So, okay, let's switch gears. Some of the other topics you mentioned earlier, you said that some of the economic announcements this week and that rates and the dollar have risen this week as well on those results. What can you tell us about it?
Well, there were three data points that I think the fixed income and currency traders really focused on, and especially Tuesday at the open. We have the retail sales figures for April, which rose 0.3%, with core up 0.4%. And the Empire Manufacturing Survey also came out on Tuesday, which climbed to 20.1 in May from last month's 15.8. So a big climb in these current month surveys for May, which is what we look at as a leading indicator for activity this month. And coming away from those two results, the Treasuries cleared the 3% range. And we headed up later on in the week towards, I think, the high this week was around 3.11%, rates we haven't seen for quite some time. The key in the manufacturing survey was prices paid component which essentially rose to the highest level we've seen in several years. The other economic news that came in this week was the Philly Fed survey for that region for May. It rose to 34.4 from 23.2 in April. So a big jump there too. And here too, the prices received index jumped 7 points to 36.4, the highest since February 1989. The industrial production figures, also another number that came in this week pretty nicely, not hot, but up to 0.7%, which helped the industrial sector later on towards the end of the week. And then there's the leading economic indicators. They came out from the conference board, came out Thursday. They were up about 0.4% in April, which was just, if you looked at the individual components inside, they were solid all the way through. The issue, like I said, John, earlier for essentially the financials is the flat yield curve. So yes, the 10-year treasury rose 3%, but so did the 2-year. The 2-year also rose, and it's just flatter than a pancake. Let me give you a comparison, John. Back in 2011, when the 10-year was at the very same levels we're talking about right now, the 2-year yielded 0.4%, and the 30-year was 4.3%. So, you know, a nice upwardly sloping yield curve from short-term maturities to long. Right now, let me give it to you again, the same 2-year, 10-year, and 30-year is 2.55, 3.06, and 3.2.
You've created a new term, FTP, flatter than a pancake.
FTP. FTP protocol? I know that in technology, but yeah, flatter than a pancake.
Yeah, indeed. All right. Well, you know, the other thing too here is that the 10-year Bund was 3% back then, and recently it was around 0.57%. So that complicates things, you know, if you look at it, the long end of the curve, and it is really hard for the U.S. to be that much higher than other government bond issues.
Yeah, I mean, the U.S. has the highest yields in the G10 all the way through, the 2, the 5, the 10, all across the board.
Well, which actually brings us to the Federal Reserve, which, according to some people out there, is largely to blame for the flat curve. And as you mentioned, it was Fed speak week. We're coming up with all these slogans and slangs around here. It was Fed speak week.
I know. It's time to hashtag this stuff, right?
Yeah, let's do it. I like that. FTP. Let's see. We've got FTP, flatter than a pancake. Fed speak week. We should, what do we call it? FSW. Okay. And there were many comments, by the way, from various Fed speakers on monetary policy and also the yield curve in particular.
Yeah, there was plenty to talk about essentially this week. No one speaker had any direct influence on the markets, but I think their commentary, if you take a look at the message that's coming across, is that this is very much going to be an issue to discuss in the very near future. Maybe we'll start to hear it in some of the press conferences with Janet Yellen. But let's listen in on the St. Louis Fed president, James Bullard, in an interview he had with Bloomberg earlier this week to get sort of an idea of where this conversation is going.
But there are people on Wall Street right now saying that we're going to get to 3.5% by the end of the year, maybe even a little bit higher.
On the
10-year note yield.
On the 10-year, yes. But people are also saying the Fed's going to raise rates 3 times, so that would be 75 basis points. So that would be even flatter yield curve than what we have today. So I tried to get this debate going with a talk late November last year. And I think it's a good debate to have at the Fed, and I think that the other members are talking about it, and I think that's the important thing at this point.
The risk is recession?
Well, if the yield curve does invert, and we're not there yet, but if the yield curve does invert, I would take that as a bearish signal for the U.S. economy, because it means that the market has a different view of the future than what the Fed has. I think global interest rates are still low, and I think we have to keep that in mind, and so that what's normal today is lower than what it's been in the past. And people have been talking about this for quite a while, but I don't think we can't lose sight of that is the main idea.
And that was Federal Reserve James Bullard.
Yeah, and that was early just this week. There were a lot of Fed speakers. He also said early this week that we're not in any danger of a breakout in inflation. And so why are we being, in his terms, he feels aggressive towards raising interest rates? And he has no problem, he said, with overshooting their 2% target. He also said it's been the Fed, I think that has flattened the curve more than worries by investors on the state of the economy. Those were his comments. He's been talking about this issue since late 2017. Then let's moving on to another Fed president, Atlanta Fed president Bostic this week said he's in the camp. He's concerned over yield curve inversion and that it's his job to make sure that doesn't happen. Pretty strong words there. Dallas Fed president Robert Kaplan this week said he sees inflation rising, but not running away, and the Fed should avoid knowingly inverting the yield curve. So that's three people now. Then there's on the other side, the Cleveland Fed's Loretta Mester, who said that she basically reiterated her support for the current gradual path and sees the need to possibly raise rates above the neutral rate of 3%. There was more conversation on that, but I don't want to get too technical here from Williams. What is the neutral rate? Is it 3%? Is it lower? There's a lot of conversation on that too, very academic. But believing also that recent inflation, this is Mester, reflects commodity prices and believes it's temporary, but they help reinforce essentially her view of a gradual path. And I want to go back to actually what something Bullard said. He said that some view that the Fed can raise rates three times. He doesn't mean three times in 2018. He means three more times. We've already had one. So that would be, again, going back to several weeks that I've been talking about what the percentage probability is towards four rate hikes this year. So rates were in focus this week, and that hurts utilities. They were down 3.2% this week. Real estate down 3.2% as well. Energy and materials, an area that's been performing based off of the idea of manufacturing doing well. Obviously, still some geopolitical issues with Iran. Also, inventory supply issues with the U.S. Those two were the best performers, up around 1.5% for both.
Okay, so they're at rest for the week. It's going to be interesting as we go forward, see if anything changes. Any other closing thoughts, Ryan?
No, I think we hit the main ones. You know, interest rates, the yield curve. We've got now, as I mentioned, three Fed presidents who believe that we are in danger of inverting it. And what Bullard said, an inverted yield curve doesn't mean we go right into inflation. It's a warning signal. And he, in that interview, he also stated that the San Francisco Fed had done a paper recently this year that again reiterates how important and how relevant that yield curve, when it does invert, how it typically corresponds with a recession around the corner. Like he said, Bullard, essentially when yield curve inverts, that shows that the market has a much different view of the economy and interest rates and inflation than the Fed does.
Okay, Ryan Poplava, see you again next week. Appreciate it.
Talk to you then.
Should you buy and hold at a market top? At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we believe valuations, leading economic indicators, and other metrics are essential for prudent investing to both identify long-term opportunities and minimize risk. Every day, we keep a watchful eye on the markets, continually assessing the investment landscape so you can focus on the things you love most. Don't put your hard-earned wealth at risk.
Give us a call at Financial Sense Advisors. Call toll-free, 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. You know, Financial Sense NewsHour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense NewsHour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
This could be the first example of what it's going to be like for the rest of the economy as technology advances. You know, for decades we've been saying, what happens if we have robots running companies, okay? You know, that's been talked about, and we've had various scholars looking at it. But we haven't had a test case yet where that happens. So it's not going to be in this case that the 500 stocks in the S&P had a huge percentage of them run totally by robots. It's going to be that the pricing and the valuing of what they do is being done in a robotic fashion, taking out the great safety mechanism, which is that you've got so many millions and millions of people making individual decisions about pricing. It reminds me of that first attempt at this which was just when I came into the business in the early 70s, and using the power of a gigantic computer of the time, which had about the same strength as my laptop now, the forecast was made for economic growth, and this was a big thing. It was announced, and then the Arabs invaded Israel, oil prices quadrupled, and we went into a recession, and so it blew it out. And they said, what went wrong? And they said, well, we had 200 factors that we used in our forecast, but since there had been no change in oil prices for decades, we didn't include oil prices as a factor. So what will the factor be that somebody said, well, isn't worth feeding into the system?
Well, since the end of January, the market seems to be going sideways. We may have a week or two where stocks go up, but then it's followed by another downturn, including this week's rise in the 10-year yield, finally crossing the 3% level. Joining us on the program from Sir Charts-A-Lot is Gary Dorsch. Gary, let's begin with the stock market, because it seems to have difficulty staying in positive territory. We may be there up 1 week or 2 weeks, and then all of a sudden we go back down again. Let me get your take on the stock market. Is this a time correction, in your opinion, as some analysts believe, or is this reflecting some of the broader problems that we're seeing globally?
Well, the market is in a tug of war between those who are focusing on the spectacular increase in earnings growth from the S&P 500 index as a whole. Profits up about 24% compared with a year ago. And then on the other hand, we have higher interest rates, which are not done going higher yet. We have further to go with the Fed tightening and higher bond yields, I believe, on the horizon. So that'll be a headwind yet to encounter. And trouble overseas, especially in the emerging markets, with sharp sell-offs today and this last week or two in some key emerging currencies and bond markets, which may start to slow down some of the faster growing economies in the world, which could eventually have a feedback loop to the more advanced economies in the G7. So with all that said, the balance of power does seem to be evenly balanced between what will be a further tightening of Fed policy, two or three more rate hikes this year by the Fed, with a quarter point rate hike guaranteed at the upcoming meeting in June. And then, according to the futures market, almost 100% chance of another rate hike in September, and better than even chance of another rate hike in December. But more devastating for the markets would be the continuation of quantitative tightening, in which the Fed is on course to drain $420 billion of its liquidity through quantitative tightening, reducing its balance sheet by $420 billion of securities between now and the end of the year, with $50 billion a month rolling off in the fourth quarter. And that in itself is equivalent to a significant increase in short-term interest rates. And so market must overcome that. The money that is flowing into the market is largely concentrated into a handful of maybe a dozen stocks. We're all familiar with the high-tech internet index, XLK, and the internet titans out of Silicon Valley and Amazon, which are holding up this market almost single-handedly. Roughly two-thirds of the gain in the S&P this year is due to about four or five different companies. And the S&P is only up 2% for the year. So this will probably go on for a while, but the buybacks are going on at a record pace. About $150 billion of buybacks in the first quarter, buybacks projected at anywhere from a total of $650 to $800 billion this year. That is largely offsetting the draining of liquidity by the Fed. And we have a shrinking market. The number of companies listed is shrinking due to mergers and acquisitions, and the number of shares listed is shrinking due to buybacks. So it's difficult to short sell a shrinking market. That's where we get the buoyancy, and the earnings growth has been largely discounted at current prices. The huge run-up from 2017 anticipated this growth in the earnings. I think overall, though, my position would be to start raising cash, selling positions on rallies, as I think it will become turbulent in the second half of the year, as the Fed continues on draining liquidity and the unprecedented withdrawal from quantitative easing, now known as quantitative tightening, is going to possibly flatten the market and even lead to some minor declines in the second half of the year for the stock market. Wouldn't look for more than a 5% pullback from current levels. With the S&P at 2715, I don't see it falling much below 5% from here, given the buyback support.
Gary, let me ask you this. In 2015 and 2016, the Fed started out the year, they were going to raise interest rates two or three times. We had the China slowdown scare, and we had problems overseas in Europe. Could, if the emerging markets continue, as there's $3 trillion in dollar-denominated loans, U.S. interest rates are far higher here than any place else, could emerging market turbulence give the Fed a reason to pause? Right now, the markets seem to think that they're going to go and raise three more times this year. But if the world starts falling apart in emerging markets, could they pull back and be a little bit more hesitant as they were in 2015 and 2016?
Well, Federal Reserve Chairman Jay Powell addressed that very question in a speech on May 8th that he gave in Zurich before the IMF, and he said the Fed is going to continue on with tightening liquidity. He felt that emerging markets could handle higher interest rates and tighter liquidity. So he did address that. He feels that emerging currencies are largely influenced by the direction of commodity prices and have been somewhat divorced from the Fed's policy. I think he's going to find out that he's mistaken about that when he starts to take a second look at what's been happening since he made that speech. And there's been massive devaluations of the Argentine peso, the second largest economy in Latin America. Turkey's currency has been getting battered. And the dollar is up 10% against the Russian ruble. And the Brazilian real up more than 12 or 15% against the real just in the last few weeks. And also moving 8% higher against India's rupee. So we see the most dramatic increases there. You're right, about $3.7 trillion of U.S. dollar denominated debt. And these companies are now going to have higher servicing costs. And it's we're seeing EEM, the Emerging Stock Market Index, the most widely traded stock index, trading at $46 now. That is down about 12% from its peak level in January. That is back to the February 5th lows that we had seen. So there's been a decoupling. The emerging stock markets have remained weak, testing their February's lows, whereas the U.S. and European markets, German market at least, recovered from those lows. So my guess is he'll continue on with at least two more rate hikes. And the yield on the 10-year currently around 3.06. My target that I've predicted on our last two conversations, between 3.25 to 3.5, is where I'm looking for the 10-year to go between now and the end of the year. And I'm very worried, actually, about the bond market. It may even get outside of the control of the Fed, as the U.S. Treasury is going to be selling a net $840 billion of debt this year through the fiscal year ended in September, and another $1 trillion of fresh debt in each of the next few years. Just a massive tsunami of debt, which could ultimately swamp the bond market. And so we may even see the 10-year eventually hit 4%. So these are the risks that equity investors, at least for now, have been lucky enough to dodge those bullets. But if the interest rates do ratchet as high as I think they will, it could start to do some damage to the U.S. real estate market. And if real estate prices start coming down, that could scare the general public into pulling back on spending. And that's how we can get a negative feedback loop through the general economy and even eventually, you know, translating into maybe a weaker stock market. So that's why I would start pulling back.
Yeah, we saw mortgage rates just hit high this week. We're at 4.6%. So, you know, that's up another 10 basis points. I want to talk about the possibility of an inversion, because there's only about a half a point spread between the 2-year note and the 10-year note. Could we possibly see, assuming the Fed goes again in June, they also go in September, which could take the 2-year note up to close to 3%. And if we've got, at that point, a 10-year note that's only at 3.25 or 3.5. I mean, could we see an inversion? And everybody knows what an inverted yield curve would imply.
I don't think it'll contract much further from where it is now. I think the 50-point spread will basically hold. As the Fed raises short-term rates, I expect long-term rates to go up pretty much the same amount. We would only see a further contraction if the stock market does indeed drop by 5 or 10%. Then money from stocks would run into bonds as a safe haven, but that's not even a real safe haven. The bond market used to be a safe haven, but I think it's dangerous to even think of that, but we could still see some money running into bonds nonetheless. So you would have to see a sustained decline of 5-10% in the stock market and maybe a deeper correction than we have seen before we'd see some type of further contraction of the yield curve. I'm not expecting that. The most I would see is a 5% drop from here. But if I'm wrong and things accelerate to the downside, then yes, we could get further contraction. As we get towards, if we were to get below 50 basis points, closer towards zero, then the Fed would stop tightening. It would go on pause. But even that may not be enough to prevent further damage to the bond market, as the amount of debt that the Treasury will be selling could even cause a mini debt crisis in this country, as we are totally reckless with our finances. And the tax cuts was a dangerous game, in my opinion. We saw the short-term benefits for shareholders, but it could now lead to much higher interest rates, which could negate a lot of the beneficial impact from the tax cuts. And we have higher oil prices, higher inflation, which is becoming further embedded in the world economy as well, which helped to keep interest rates up and on the long end as well.
I want to talk about something that we haven't seen in a long time. And if you look at a chart of the CRB index, Gary, it's almost the lowest it's been in 50 years. You'd have to go back to 1972. We now have rising oil prices and the CRB has been ticking up. Let's move on to energy, commodities in general. What's your take there?
U.S. oil production hit a record high of 10.6 million barrels a day. It is remarkable how fast the U.S. shale oil company is able to convert these wells into producing wells, just a matter of a few weeks. And although we have seen U.S. oil production increase by about 1.6 million barrels a day since the beginning of 2017, that has been overtaken by the sharp decline in oil production from Venezuela. Venezuela's oil production has dropped from about 2.6 million barrels a day to 1.4 million and could be dropping much further as Venezuela's economy and structure at Petróleos de Venezuela is deteriorating rapidly. So I've seen some projections of further declines of substantial amounts out of Venezuela, and plus the OPEC cartel in Russia took 1.8 million barrels off the market through a joint effort, and they are apparently sticking with that. So it seems to me that oil prices are currently at 79 for North Sea Brent. We had 80. It's possible we might even get up to 85 to 90 a barrel in the short term. And so I see nothing on the horizon that could cause a major drop. In fact, the tensions in the Middle East are as dangerous I have seen in decades. We, of course, had military altercations between the Israeli Air Force and the Iranian Revolutionary Guards in Syria, which could have turned into a major widespread war in the Middle East. And that's still an ongoing problem. In fact, just today, a major Iranian airbase used in Syria had 11 massive explosions today. And so that is a very hotbed of tension that could turn into something very dangerous. And of course, now President Trump has withdrawn the United States from the Iran deal, which within 3 to 6 months is going to reduce the supply of Iranian oil. And the question is by how much? My guess is maybe up to 1 million barrels a day of Iranian oil could come off the market as a result of U.S. sanctions. Most European companies and other companies will choose to do business with the United States before doing business with Iran. But the Saudi Arabians and the UAE have indicated they will make up the difference from anything lost from Iran. So that might be a net wash. But still, the tension militarily is going to be there and keeping the price up. So we are living in very interesting times, to say the least. U.S. oil apparently is trading at about an $8 discount to North Sea Brent, just perhaps because of more ample supplies here locally and lower transportation costs. But other than that, I see oil prices going up another $5 or $10 a barrel before they start to flatten out.
Yeah, I've seen projections, and even though U.S. shale production is increasing, they're running into bottlenecks. They can't get the stuff either on pipelines or get it to where they need to go. So we're selling at a steep discount to elsewhere. And it seems like you almost have a perfect storm emerging in energy, as you just talked about the political implications. Now the U.S. is backing out from Iran. That's taking oil off the market. We have it happening in Nigeria. We have it happening in Venezuela. And even in Canada, they're arguing over a pipeline. So you've got oil in Texas and in Canada that needs a venue to get it to where it needs to go. And it's being stopped for either bottlenecks or environmental reasons. And so that only adds to the tension. And it doesn't seem like, Gary, we're seeing anything coming out of OPEC that they're going to say, well, you know, that 1.8 million of production cuts, maybe it's time to start producing more again.
Well, they need to make back what they lost over the last few years. Their break-even costs are not just what it costs to come out of the well, but to balance their budgets. And Saudi Arabia at least has sort of told the media that we'd like to see oil settle around 80, but I wouldn't be surprised if it overshoots before they maybe take some type of remedial action.
So given your take on the markets from what you see right here, given the fact that we know propping up the markets, we have stock buybacks, which are at record levels, and of course with the cut in tax cuts and on corporate tax rates, and then of course repatriation of cash coming back, companies are using that to buy back stock. So you do have one big prop underneath the market. But will that prop be big enough, Gary, to hold this market up despite all these headwinds we've been speaking about?
That is the multi-million dollar question. I can't wait to find out what the answer is. Where is the threshold of pain? How high do interest rates have to go before we see another sharp sell-off in the stock market like we saw in the first week of February, when the market first recognized that we had taken out the highest yield for 2017 on the 10-year, and then we knew we were in a new era of higher rates. And market, I don't think, has really fully grasped that we're going to see interest rates go even higher yet. And so my guess is we probably would need to see the 10-year get closer to 3.5% before you would see, you know, more than a 5% pullback in the S&P 500 index. You have the technology sector, which is just rock solid, and the energy sector now finally contributing to the upside. Those are your key supports there. But yeah, eventually, tighter liquidity, if the Fed does continue with quantitative tightening, will be draining out $40 billion a month starting in the third quarter, and $50 billion a month of excess liquidity drained in the fourth quarter, and then $50 billion a month every month for next year. That's an enormous amount of liquidity. And for those who have been arguing the market was artificially propped up by the Fed, as we get to higher rates and less liquidity, we'll see whether those perceptions were true or not. So overall, I do believe that we are at the very best in a holding pattern going sideways. But if the interest rates do go as high as I believe, 3.25 to 3.5 by the end of the year on the 10-year, looking for, you know, 5% pullback in the S&P. The gold market is now tracking the dollar, and that's the other variable. Higher U.S. interest rates were not supporting the dollar last year. Even though the Fed was raising rates, the dollar index dropped 12%. And of course, the narrative was traders were worried about the enormous U.S. budget deficits and U.S. trade deficits. But now the narrative has changed, as it so often does, and now traders are focusing on higher U.S. interest rates. And that the increase in U.S. rates is already steamrolling some of the emerging currencies, will eventually is also now pulling the dollar up against the euro, the yen, and the British pound, and you know, that will continue. The other variable, the Bank of European Central Bank apparently will mothball its QE program in at the end of September. That's only 4 months from now. We won't have injections from the European Central Bank. That's another risk for the bond and stock markets. The ECB is still quite a ways off from raising rates. And, of course, now there's a new government in Italy, which is getting all the attention. We've seen a sharp ratcheting upward of Italian bond yields as the new Italian government is ready to bust its budget in contravention to the euro's budgetary policies. And, of course, Italy is the third largest economy in Europe, has the third largest bond market in the world behind the U.S. and Japan. And so we need to keep an eye on the powder keg out of Italy. And this also is a government that are euro skeptics. Although they are not talking about moving out of the euro today, they have talked quite a bit about it in the past. And that's a risk in the back of people's minds. So that could undermine the euro as well, which a stronger dollar is depressing the value of gold. So gold is pretty much tracking where the dollar is. And I would expect the U.S. dollar will continue to go higher as the Fed raises rates unilaterally and drains liquidity. So that would mean gold will probably continue to trend lower, currently around 1290, maybe get down to around 1250, maybe the low 1200, 1225 area. As the Fed continues on with its tightening program.
Gary, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, tell them how they could do so, please.
Well, I have a website in cyberspace. So you can find me at globalmoneytrends.com, and you can take a look at some of the articles at that webpage, and that's where you can find me.
Do you know what everyone wants? Everyone wants the ability to retire and live well. Sounds easy, but it isn't. It requires careful planning. That is something not everyone knows how to do, and you may need help to plan, implement, and monitor your progress, assessing where you are now and where you want to be in the future. That is where Financial Sense Advisors can help. And unlike many advisors who sell you products you don't need, at Financial Sense Advisors, we are fiduciaries, which means we put your interest first. We do well when you do well.
Call Financial Sense Advisors now and let us help you to make the change from just retiring to thriving in retirement. Call now, toll free, 888-486-3939. Again, that's 888-486-3939. Investment advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor.
If you're approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at FinancialSense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining me on the program is Mark Kantrowitz from StudentAidPolicy.com. And Mark, I want to start out with an article that you wrote about student aid. We just hit the milestone of $1.5 trillion, actually over that. Let's talk about that and what this means for the average student. I think you wrote one out of six graduates leave college with debt that exceeds their income.
Right. So if your total debt at graduation is less than your starting salary, you should be able to repay your student loans in 10 years or less. When your total debt exceeds your annual income, you'll need an alternate repayment plan like extended repayment or income-driven repayment in order to afford those loan payments. And that means you'll be in debt for, instead of 10 years, you'll be in debt for 20, 25, or even 30 years.
Well, for almost 2 years, if you wanted to talk about the oil market, you were talking about the oil glut. There was so much oil, they were actually storing it on ships. Fast forward to today, and we're talking about the opposite.
we could be talking about a potential oil shock. Joining me on the program is oil analyst Kurt Wolf. Kurt, you've been through so many of these cycles in oil. We seem to go from one extreme to another. We either are looking at some of the lowest prices, as we were in February of 2016, when the price of oil got down to 26. And here on the day you and I are talking, it's at over $71 a barrel. So let's talk about where we are with oil. We're no longer talking about a glut. In fact, we're still talking about a possible oil shock. The fact that the president is withdrawing from the agreement from Iran can pull additional oil off. And let's talk about some of the other troubled spots. One is Venezuela, which has an election this Sunday. The other one is possibly Canada, where they have oil in Alberta, and you have a government in BC that doesn't want to have a pipeline for environmental reasons. So you've got all these geopolitical bottlenecks that are now adding to already a very, very tight market.
Yeah, that's right. I think we're in a balance right now. $70 a barrel is my long-term number. We're not quite there yet. You couldn't sell your oil a year from now for $70 in the U.S. futures market. So we're very close to a balanced point. We've got way below it, as you say, and we have the chances of going way above it. But the investments look pretty good right here. And you raised the issue on a few things that might help us do better. Supply and demand is pretty much in balance at this stage. Economic growth is pretty good. So supply and demand, the balance is going in the right direction, although that's a pretty delicate balance. It can be an upset in either way. The momentum now seems to be to the upside. So stocks are priced close to the $70 barrel number. We would keep riding with them and hope we can make some more money here, just like we had to be patient the last couple of years. You mentioned Venezuela. I think that's been in the news, and that's a real basket case. The news that Venezuela is arresting Chevron employees was a shock to me, because I've always thought that Chevron had done their best over the years just to stay in touch with Venezuela. When Exxon got out of Venezuela, Chevron stayed there. So that's a measurement of the extreme. And ConocoPhillips has got a judgment against Venezuela. They're commandeering assets in the Caribbean. It just gets worse and worse. The other one you mentioned was Canada. Well, of course, Canada is no worse than the U.S. in terms of trying to move oil and gas across one state to another if the state wants to resist. We see that in New York on natural gas going to Pennsylvania to New England. But in Canada, we couldn't get a pipeline going out to the East Coast, and now we can't get a pipeline expanded on the West Coast. You know, there are two sides to that. There's an opportunity that the settlement in British Columbia might be that the oil pipeline gets approved and then the natural gas pipeline gets approved through northern British Columbia. Most people in British Columbia want the gas pipeline. A vocal minority doesn't want the oil pipeline. But I'm not an expert on British Columbia politics. It's been pretty bad, and maybe it can get a little bit better for the supply picture. But for the time being, supplies are tight.
You know, the amazing thing about this is OPEC pumped a lot of oil out, and they thought they were going to put a lot of frackers out of business. They did put a few of them out of business, but American industry adapted, so it backfired. So they came up with this agreement to cut production by 1.8 million barrels, and that went into effect, and all of a sudden we're working off these surpluses. But the other thing that is adding to the market's tightness are the very events that we're talking about, whether it's a pipeline coming out of Alberta, whether it's geopolitics in Venezuela, where its production has dropped precipitously, whether you're having geopolitical problems off the coast of Africa. So, you know, these are the kind of things that sort of add to already what OPEC's doing. So I guess the big question the market is trying to assess is, as prices head higher, what will be the response by American frackers? And number two, will OPEC extend the production cuts at the end of the year when they're due to expire? If so, what will that mean to the market going into next year? So these are the kind of things that I guess weigh in on the market. But let's talk about, Kurt, what's going on with the stocks themselves? Because if we look at the stocks that have done very well, they've been some of the companies that are, I guess, pursuing policies that are shareholder friendly. They're cutting back on expenditures. They're raising dividends. They're buying back stock. And those are the stocks that seem to be rewarded in the market. Now, if you look at somebody that is taking a longer-term view, like, for example, let's take Exxon. Barron's just did a front cover story on Exxon and saying Exxon is a bet on oil. The companies that are going to bet on oil, and as you and I know, some of these projects are long-lasting projects. They take years to bring into fruition. And those companies have been lagging the market. For example, Exxon announced they're going to spend $50 billion investing domestically in the U.S., mainly in shale plays. But the stock hasn't been extremely rewarded for something like that, which is a long-term view on investing.
Yeah, Exxon is still lagging. It's had a pretty good move in the last couple of weeks from a surprisingly low point. I went to the Exxon analyst meeting back in March, and I got a lot of heat from analysts on their spending program being too ambitious, and why didn't they just buy back stock? My conclusion was that, well, I think we've got to give Exxon the benefit of the doubt. They made a case that by 2025, their oil production and the world's oil production would be down very sharply, and that by then the new oil production developed between now and 2025 would be half of Exxon's cash flow and profit. So the depletion factor is a real one. It goes down pretty fast every year. You have to keep reinvesting just to keep production where it is. And Exxon, they had some pretty good projects. But a criticism of Exxon spending too much and not taking care of shareholders, it's kind of surprising because over the years, Exxon has increased its dividend pretty sharply, and they bought back a huge amount of their stock in the last 10 years. So they've been a leader in returning money to shareholders. And my thinking is, well, let's give the management the benefit of the doubt here. But overall, I like the argument that companies should be giving some money back to shareholders. That's a compromise. You know, companies are so enthusiastic sometimes that they think you're going to make a lot of money in their new projects, and then the time comes to make that money, they don't actually make as much money. So the shareholders would like to see a return on that investment and not just keep waiting indefinitely. So the compromise position is to pay a pretty solid dividend that can be increased and to buy back stock when it makes sense. So I think Exxon has met that compromise pretty well, but a lot of other companies could be doing more. I actually visited with a small company this week that was in a growth mode over the years, and they pay a 2.5% dividend, and they're generating free cash flow, and they're going to be probably buying back stock over the next several years. So that captures the theme. Now, in my view, it all depends on what the future price of oil is. So investments today are going to look good if the price of oil is up in the future. They're not going to look so good if the price of oil is down. So the price of oil makes a big difference here. We think the price has got upward momentum here, so these companies that have been overspending and now are trying to be a little more cautious could generate a significant free cash flow in the next few years. What we don't see yet is whether they'll change their mind when they generate the free cash flow and decide to reinvest it instead. But for the time being, I think the balance is pretty good.
I want to talk about a couple other issues. Now, the bears on oil will argue in the next 10 years, you and I are going to be driving Teslas or some kind of electric car. Now, if you look at the average fleet age in this country, it's about 9 years that people hold their cars, and most of those cars have been replaced in this last business recovery. So even if in 10 years everybody's going to be driving an electric car, it's not just the fact that you're driving an electric car. Kurt, you're going to have infrastructure put in place, and I'm starting to see it in a few places in California, like in shopping centers. They put in a few charging stations in some of the parking spaces. I've seen it at hotels. But you're going to have, just like we have gas stations strewn all over the country, you're going to have charging stations, or I don't know what they're going to do, replace batteries. But you also have to have an infrastructure that's going to support electric cars.
Yeah, that's quite an exciting issue. And I live up here in the Boston area where I'm an oil guy. I'm a little bit like a fish out of water in New England pushing oil. There's so many technology people here. So the people who work in technology business tend to be enthusiastic about rapid change. And I think that in the energy business, change is rapid, but it doesn't come quite as fast as it did, of course, in the technology business. And the biggest technological change is really fracking. It's making oil and gas even cheaper than it would have been otherwise. So on electric cars, I think the optimists are understating the size of the fleet, how long it takes to roll over, the time it takes to build infrastructure. I know that in my case, I thought that natural gas cars were going to take off at one time. In 1990, I installed the wiring and the piping in my house so I could have a natural gas compressor. I never actually did it, but I thought that within 10 years, natural gas cars might have, 5% of the market. Well, they haven't come close. And so I'm skeptical. And early in my career, nuclear power was going to be taking over the energy business. And then we saw that in the end, it was much, much, much more expensive than people thought. And now we're actually seeing nuclear power shrinking in the U.S. It never got past single-digit percentage of the total energy market. So I think electric cars are very exciting, but they're not going to be adopted as fast as the optimists think they are. Exxon makes the case that if all the new cars in 2040 were electric, I think I remember this right, there would still be growth in the oil market because gasoline is only part of the transportation market, and transportation is a big part of oil, but it's not all of oil. What Exxon concluded was that natural gas would be growing more rapidly because where's the electricity going to come from for these electric cars?
Yeah, especially when we're shutting down nuclear power plants, as we've done here in California. And it's not to mention, Kurt, those big ships that we see, whether it's Carnival Cruise Lines or it's ships that are bringing containers of goods and world trade, ships, trains, airplanes, they still run on a oil product.
Yes. Actually, that's an exciting new trend because the ships have tended to use the dirtiest oil. They use residual fuel oil. And now there are international agreements to use cleaner oil fuel, low sulfur diesel, for example. So the refiners are excited about the prospect for the low sulfur diesel market. But that's a small point. When you were thinking about ships, I was thinking about liquefied natural gas, LNG tankers. And the LNG business has picked up a lot this year. My position has always been that LNG is a small percentage of the world market, and natural gas is a small percentage of the energy market. And China is almost an unlimited market for natural gas and for LNG. So China did buy a lot more LNG this year, and it firmed up the LNG market. And those prospects are looking good.
Now, we've been talking about supply, but one thing that we've seen is oil demand, and especially when prices dropped, have been going up globally. The IEA just reduced with higher prices. They reduced the increase this year from 1.5 to 1.4 million barrels a day of increased demand. And by the end of the year, you know, we're going to be close to 100 million barrels a day of consumption. So during this whole period, even during the glut, oil consumption was going up. Now, as you look at the industry and you follow the big stocks, the mid cap, and some of the smaller stocks, what has happened with the rise in prices, profits, and let's not forget they cut the tax rates? The way you analyze companies, you use something called a McDepp ratio that analyzes future oil revenues with profits. What are your McDepp ratios looking like in terms of value right now that prices have gone up and so have stocks?
That's a timely question. I think this is a good market for the McDepp technique, where we have an uptrend going. And you and I have all emphasized the very big companies a lot in our conversations. And if you're a huge investor, you want to play oil and gas, you want to buy the big companies. You might buy the ones with good dividend yields like Exxon, Chevron, and Royal Dutch. But now we're seeing that investors have been buying those companies to some extent, and the industry is looking a lot better. The more people are positive on oil, so we're turning our interest to the E&P companies. In the E&P sector, I've got three size categories, large, mid-size, and small, and there's a huge difference in the market perception of those three stocks. So the market's going for the big guys first. Their McDepp ratios are the highest of the independent exploration companies. The mid-size are in between, and the small caps are still much lower. Of course, the small caps are more risk. Smaller size is more risk. Mid-size are more risk than large independents. So if you think that the oil stocks are doing better, then we are in an upswing. Well, you know, there's some exciting higher risk profits to be made in the mid-sized independents. The small independents illustrate the risk-reward situation. Well, I've got just four small-cap stocks. Two of them are oil and two of them are gas. The gas stocks have just been killed. Nobody wanted these stocks in the last year or so. They're down 50, 60, 70%. The oil stocks were on one or two, but now with the oil price picking up, the two oil stocks in that small-cap group are up more than 80% this year. Now, they're not high-quality companies in the sense they have a fair amount of debt, although, you know, they do have high-quality properties, just that they were independent companies, too much debt, and in a downtrend, they were very much out of favor. They're coming back. The oil companies are coming back. The group that's not coming back yet, but if you're cautious, conservative, want to wait, there may be a play in natural gas someday. It's probably too early for us to talk about today because natural gas has been disappointing for so long. But there's definite opportunity in mid-cap and smaller-cap independents. And I think the integrated companies are still not priced for $70 a barrel of oil. They earn a very nice return at these oil price levels, and they pay good dividends. And the stocks are attractive. They're moving up. And if you like small cap income, that's a specialized category that I cover. They're still yielding 8% or something like that. As the oil price goes up, their stock price goes up because the amount they pay out goes up, and therefore they still keep a high percentage return on their investment. They're pure commodity plays too, so they'll really reflect improving commodity values.
Yeah, some of them that have done real well, and this also applies to larger integrated companies, is the refiners. You know, I own a couple of refiners, and, you know, they've taken off like rocket ships with these crack spreads being as wide as they are. But, you know, the bigger companies, your Chevrons, your Exxons, they're in the downstream business too. So that's one of the advantages of investing in integrateds.
That's a good point that I would make. And of course, the refiners in the U.S. are doing fabulously well, with the U.S. crude oil price under a little pressure because we can't get it to market fast enough. So the U.S. refiners can buy U.S. crude cheap. And at the same time, the product market is priced by the world price of crude, which is higher. So there's a real big differential built in there that we normally don't have. But, you know, it'll probably be there for a little while yet. So those refiners are doing fabulously well. And of course, Exxon and Chevron are two huge refiners in the U.S., but they're refiners worldwide. Suncor is a good example of that. That stock's come alive here recently, even though it's a Canadian producer and it's subject to some of these problems with the pipelines in Canada. But to the extent that the crude oil is limited in volume growth now, they're also in the refining business. So they say they've made up, as you can see it in their numbers, they've made it up as much in the refining business as they gave up on the crude oil side.
Well, it's amazing because, you know, one of the worries, or at least this was an argument made by the bears, is the price headed higher in the 60s and now in the 70s. American frackers were going to produce even more. We are now the second largest producer, surpassing Saudi Arabia. But one of the problems, just like in Canada, we're running into bottlenecks in the Permian Basin and elsewhere. We don't have the pipelines in the infrastructure to get all this oil out of the ground to the ports or to the refiners where they need to be.
Yeah, that's going to keep the lid on the supply for a while. Theoretically, those things get worked out eventually, but they can take a few years. The refiners can make more money on the wider spread, and the U.S. producers are they're not making quite as much now as they could, but they'll make up for it later on.
Well, the good thing about this industry, Kurt, is we say it goes through cycles, and now we're going through an up cycle with the price of oil rising, and it looks like geopolitics, whether you're looking at Venezuela, Canada, or Iran, are even adding to the price mix. But the other good thing about this industry is even during the downturn, the majors, whether you were looking at Royal Dutch, whether you were looking at Exxon, Chevron, they all maintain their dividends. And when you look at the market, those dividend yields still look attractive. Kurt, as we close, if our listeners like to follow your work, why don't you give out your website, if you would?
Yeah, my website, thanks, Jim, is McDepp.com. McDepp spelled M-C-D-E-P, like David Edward Peter. That's my analytical ratio. You can log on and see all of my historical work.
And you cover a wide range of stocks, from large to mid-cap to small to even some of the royalty companies. So, Kurt, it's a pleasure having you on the program. As always, a good time to be talking about energy compared to the several of the last interviews we had when it was in the dumps. So all the best to you, sir. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, Jim.
Ever since January, the stock market has been unable to sustain a rally, which is a surprise to many, given where the fundamentals are if we look at them. I mean, earnings are accelerating, GDP growth is picking up, government stimulus is accelerating with tax cuts and spending increases, and unemployment's at record lows. So what gives? Why the change now? Why did everything switch in January? And what does that mean as far as any kind of an oncoming crisis? That and much more coming up next on The Big Picture as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertised with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.